This is the rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shearmont Spina. Coming up on the show, we'll continue our series called Uncelebrated, people who fly under the radar yet help the world turn. And later, we've heard of snow birds coming south for the winter, but what about snow bees? We'll hear a story from WUFT's Rose Schnabel about the practice of hauling bees to Florida during the cold winter months. But first, the Florida legislative session officially began this week. Hundreds of bills have already been filed for potential review by the House and Senate. Earlier, I spoke with Tristan Wood, a state government reporter at our partner station, WFSU in Tallahassee, about what exactly we can expect to see from this session.
The Florida legislative session runs for 60 days. Depending on what year it is, this year it's starting in January and it's running to March. Because it's an election year, because it's 2026 and there will be the midterm elections. During those 60 days, legally lawmakers are required to do one thing, and that's pass a budget. But it's also the period where they pass a myriad of other bills to impact Florida law and policy. Another thing about this session specifically is that it's Governor Ron DeSantis' last session. He's in the final year of his second term. And the next legislative session next year will feature whoever wins the governor's race at the end of 2026.
And what are some of the things that we can expect to see come forward as bills this legislative session?
One issue where there seems to be some agreement is the need to pass policy that is going to provide some protections for Floridians around artificial intelligence. Governor Ron DeSantis has been using his position to advocate for what he calls an AI Bill of Rights. Among other things that this AI Bill of Rights would do would give people name, image, and likeness protections, allow parents to supervise and control and limit their children's access to artificial intelligence, and legally require that people are informed when they're interacting with artificial intelligence versus a real person.
In the last few years, there's been a lot of push and pull between state government and college campuses. Are there any bills this session that we can expect to see relating to that?
There are a couple bills that would change a lot about what on-campus life looks like. One bill would actually allow university instructors and staff to carry firearms on campus. Currently, campuses are gun-free zones. Only law enforcement can carry them. This bill would allow instructors to conceal carry on campus. The bill's sponsor, State Senator Don Gates, in promoting and supporting his bill, pointed to the shooting on Florida State University's campus in April and the assassination of Charlie Kirk at Utah Valley University in September as some of the reasons why he thinks that trusted people employed by universities should be able to have firearms. It's worth noting that both those bills have not advanced far so far, but it's still very early in the process. And lawmakers like State Senator Don Gates are pretty well respected in their chamber. So it's very possible that both of those bills do pick up steam and begin moving forward.
You mentioned that bill is picking up steam in the legislature. Can you walk me through, for people who need a quick refresher, on what exactly it takes for a bill to become a law in the state of Florida?
Going from the beginning of the process to the end, a bill is first filed by a lawmaker. Once it's filed by a lawmaker, it has to be heard by at least one committee before it can go to the full floor for a vote. So generally what ends up happening is that there is a House version and a Senate version of the bill sponsored by two separate lawmakers. It receives committee appointments, and then it has to be approved by those committees. Once it's approved by those committees, it then goes to the floor of that chamber for a vote. And once both chambers approve identical versions of the bill, it goes to the desk of Governor DeSantis. So once it gets to the governor's desk, it does not need his signature to become law. But he can, at that point, decide to veto a law if he disagrees with it.
There's been a lot of talk about redistricting across the country. Can you tell me a little bit more about how that might be affecting Florida?
So it really started last year when the Trump administration pressured Texas Republican lawmakers to redraw their congressional maps to give Republicans more seats leaning in their favor for the midterm elections this year. And now that conversation has come to Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis has announced he's going to call a special session in April to deal with the issue. But the Florida House is trying to get forward with its own maps and its proposal during this session. The reason that's really challenging is the governor and both the House and the Senate would have to be on the same page about drawing these maps. So already there's disagreement amongst them on what that process would look like, which could ultimately lead to a lot of back and forth during this session and during that potential special session about what that redistricting process and what those maps are going to look like. Kind of this mid-decade redistricting is really atypical and largely stems from this kind of like national pushing conversation from both political parties to try to get as many seats possible benefiting their party ahead of the midterms.
That was WFSU state government reporter Tristan Wood talking to me about what we can expect from the legislative session over the next 60 days. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News, exploring our community from top to bottom. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Are there things happening in your community that we haven't covered yet? Let us know. Email us at therundown@wuft.org. And if you want to listen to previous episodes, visit wuft.org/therundown or find us wherever you get your podcasts. But first, Florida has a lot of stories to tell. Do you know your community's history? It's time for a trivia question. Although she seems to have left Alachua County behind, this Saturday Night Live comedian and actor was born in Gainesville. Do you think you know? Well, stay tuned to the end of the show for the answer. Now it's time for our series we're calling Uncelebrated, people who fly under the radar yet help the world turn. Today, WUFT's Krista Jensen introduces us to a person whose work is very appreciated and widely known, and yet they themselves work quietly in the background with the expectation that they'll get little to no credit.
My name is Hella Scholl, and I'm a volunteer at the Kanapahawk Botanical Garden. And most of the time, my volunteer time is spent pulling weeds among all the lovely flowers and plants. How long have I been gardening for? I would say most of my life, because growing up, we had a garden out of necessity. So I learned from my mother. And wherever I have lived, I've always grown things. My main reason for volunteering at the Botanical Garden is because I enjoy the garden itself. I want it to thrive. I want the community to enjoy it. And while I'm not a botanist, I cannot help in the planting aspect of it, but I can help in maintaining the garden by keeping it free of weeds, debris, and just make it enjoyable for all the people who come through. Well, a weed is a plant in the wrong place. In this case, a plant becomes a weed when it's not being planted in a particular location. And we have to remove it because it interferes with the display of the plants. This is mondo grass. It's very delicate, very fine. This is a palm. It's very coarse in comparison. So it stands out in among the mondo grass, which is low and gentle. There's another one. These are definitely weeds, per se. This is a kind of a maple, but it doesn't belong here, so it gets removed. I would describe myself as a plant lover from A to Z. I like seeing them, smelling them, growing them, watching them grow, watching them through the season, how they go from sticks to being beautiful flowers, and then back to being sticks. I would say my most favorite plant is an artichoke, because in appearance, it's a large plant, bright green. It has very menacing leaves, but they're not sharp. And the flower is the most gorgeous flower. It's a big thistle. and the flower is like a big globe of purple. And it's just an absolutely fabulous looking plant. Part of the reason that I volunteer at the garden is simply because I enjoy the garden, and I hope other people enjoy the garden, and by keeping it clean and neat and tidy, they can also enjoy the garden. So I share in their joy of seeing the flowers and seeing the plants and hearing the birds, and especially owls sometimes. Just the peacefulness of it is worthwhile.
That was Hella Scholl. She's a volunteer gardener at Kanapaha Botanical Gardens. Her story is part of our series, Uncelebrated, People Who Fly Under the Radar Yet Help the World Turn. Do you have a person you think would be a perfect match for this series? Tell us about it in an email to feedback@wuft.org. This story was produced by WUFT's Krista Jensen. You can find more of her work at wuft.org/fm. This is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Still to come, we'll hear a story from WUFT environmental reporter Rose Schnabel about the practice of hauling bees on trucks south for the winter. That's after a short break.
Support for WUFT comes from the Law Office of Nellinger & Associates, a Gainesville law firm serving North Central Florida for over three decades, offering services in family law, business law, estate planning, and more. Information at lawyergainesville.com.
In the 2025 budget bill, Congress created the $50 billion Rural Health Fund to help struggling hospitals, doctors, and patients in rural America. It might seem like a lot, but it's only a third of the amount of funding that those same places will lose due to massive Medicaid cuts in that same budget bill. So what will it take to keep rural healthcare afloat? That's on the next On Point, weeknights at 8 on WUFT.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on The Middle, from tariffs to Doge cuts to a nationwide immigration crackdown to the military action in Venezuela. The first year of Trump's second presidency has brought no shortage of change. But beyond the headlines, how are the policies of the Trump administration affecting you personally? We're taking your calls next time on The Middle. Live on Thursday nights at 9 on WUFT.
A woman was shot and killed by an ICE agent during an encounter in Minneapolis. Federal officials have called the shooting an act of self-defense. I'm David Green. Join Moa Lathy, Mike Dupke, and me for Left, Right, and Center.
Thursday evening at 10 on WUFT.
Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. You may want to be extra careful passing semis on I-75 this month. They could be transporting precious cargo. Bees. Commercial beekeepers who brought their colonies to Florida for the winter are hitting the road. And as WUFT's Rose Schnabel reports, they're carrying way more bees than you might expect.
They're carrying 1.2 million in beehives that look like filing cabinets on the back of flatbed trailers. Commercial beekeepers are sometimes called migratory beekeepers because they truck their colonies all across the country. They go to Wisconsin to pollinate cranberries, to Washington to pollinate apples, and to Florida, well, to Florida for some sunshine and relaxation.
So there's two principal reasons that bees would want, that beekeepers would want their colonies to overwinter in Florida. Number one, it's an easier environment to get colonies through winter.
This is Dr. Jamie Ellis. He's a professor of entomology at the University of Florida.
The second primary reason is that one of the nation's most important honeybee pollinated crops is the almond.
Almonds bloom in January and February. In those months, the bees that live up north are just trying to survive the cold. They're clustering up into balls, almost like a state of hibernation. But in Florida, especially south of Orlando, the bees stay active.
You can grow them and ready them much more easily for movement to California from a southern state than you can from a northern state.
Now, why does it really matter if you show up to California with sleepy bees or active ones? Well, for the beekeepers, this pollination contract is often their biggest moneymaker of the whole year, more than honey sales even. And for the almonds, well, no bees, no almonds. And the U.S. produces about 80% of the world's supply, so it's a big deal. That's why beekeepers take so much care in preparing for the cross-country road trips.
We load the bees either really, really early in the morning or in the evening when it's dark out, because bees won't travel and they won't take flight when they don't have the sun to help them navigate.
A new deal runs Bee Hauling USA and the nonprofit Save the Bloom. She said crews dressed in those iconic beekeeper veils puff handheld smokers to block communication between the bees. They forklift the hives onto the flatbed and cover them with a mesh tarp to provide airflow. When the truck starts moving,
it's almost kind of mimicking a tornado, because in natural conditions, a honeybee would never come out of its hive if there were wind gusts that strong, so it just keeps them in their hive.
But if a driver stops for more than 30 minutes, say in a traffic jam.
Oh boy, like you're in trouble. Like we go release those nets and just dead bees all along the outline of the trailer, and it's really devastating and sad to see that.
A single truck of bees can be worth about $250,000, so drivers take every precaution. The Department of Transportation even exempts them from required breaks. And when they finally pause at night, they park far away from rest stop lights so the bees don't mistake the lights for the sun. It's a tough cross-country road trip for the drivers and the bees. They'll spend about a month in California, then hit the road again, repeating this truck-based migration again and again. Rose Schnabel, WUFT News.
To read the full story and see pictures from Rose's reporting, visit WUFT.org and search for the keywords beekeeper and Rose. If you're just joining us, this is The Rundown from WUFT News. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. As a reminder, our trivia question this week, although she seems to have left Alachua County behind, this Saturday Night Live comedian and actor was born in Gainesville. The answer's coming up at the end of the show. We'll be back after a quick break. Stay with us.
On the next Florida Roundup, best-selling author Brad Meltzer will be our live guest. He lives in Florida, is a top-selling author of thriller novels, an executive producer of a PBS kids show, and writes children's books. In fact, one of his books was banned by a school district in Florida. He also helped raise the flag that flew over Ground Zero in the days after 9/11. Author Brad Meltzer will be here. Send us your questions by emailing radio@thefloridaroundup.org. I'm Tom Hudson. And be sure to join us Friday, noon until 1 on WUFT.
This week on Science Friday, environmental factors that might help cause Parkinson's disease.
Air pollution, pesticides, and water.
Plus Congress pushing back to restore slashes to science funding.
It wasn't that politicians suddenly came to their senses. It was the fact that we went to the trouble of saying, why should we be champions of science?
It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Fridays at 2 on WUFT.
It wasn't all that long ago that the vast bulk of news out of Tallahassee came during the yearly lawmaking session. But as the state has grown in population and national importance, that certainly isn't true anymore, which is why you'll hear a summary of the top stories from Tallahassee every week on Capitol Report.
Friday evening at 6:30 on WUFT 89.1, 90.1.
Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina. Crying is not inherently a bad thing. It can actually be the body's natural process of healing. That's according to Kanika Inglet. She's a former microbiology professor at the University of Florida, and today she's a mental health counselor. She says tears help release pent-up stress and tension, and it's not just water and salt that's being released in a tear. It's the actual stress hormone. WUFT's Faith Smith spoke with her about why crying isn't embraced more in today's culture, despite its apparent benefits. She first asked Inglet, how do you interpret the role of crying in emotional healing?
The common understanding is that crying is very cathartic. So crying would be like a vent to those difficult emotions which are building in ourselves.
What got you started in counseling? Because to my understanding, this wasn't your main focus at first.
During my work at UF with a lot of students, I mentored and I guided a lot of students who went through my lab. And something that I realized was that the content that the students had to learn the scientific content was difficult, especially for students who were coming from different cultures. So there were so many barriers that they were anyways had to go through before they feel calm, and then the learning could begin.
Yeah, so there, you're saying that there are emotional benefits to allowing oneself to cry. Is it that there are more positives to that, or is it because that there are more negative associations with holding back those tears?
Yeah, I think I want to say both. So the positives are, for example, the oxytocin is a bonding hormone, which is it drives connection between people when you go through that process, because it brings a calmness to us. The endorphins part is that, you know, it's a painkiller when you exercise and things like that. So it helps you give you a little bit of a happiness part of it. The third part is the cortisol, which is the stress hormone, which is in our body. So when we get stressed, the cortisol is starting to pump up. So the crying is a way to release the excess cortisol in the body.
Have you noticed differences in men and women or different generations in how they view crying?
I think culturally, there's some cultures where I feel they encourage men not to cry a lot more than other cultures. I come from India, and there is a sense of a lot of times men are taught also not to cry. Even now, even girls, there is a sense of, no, we don't need to cry. We just need to push through this. We are strong enough. But there is still a sense of, I want to use the word shame, because in some cultures, it's just a little bit more that it's shameful for boys or men to cry. Or in fact, I want to switch that and say it's shameful for strong people to cry, because now women are also encouraged to be strong. And one of the things that is being also on the side being encouraged is you don't cry, you just push through and white knuckle through situations.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. How do cultural or societal expectations influence how freely people do cry?
I find myself having to switch my own cultural expectations in my mind when I switch from one culture to another, even to the extent how you do grief. So it's more personal, whether it's more you share with people. And I'll give you a quick example. So in some cultures, I will speak in some Indian cultures, and I think some Middle Eastern cultures too, there are professional mourners who come when there is a death. Their main goal is to create an environment where there is a loud weeping and mourning of for the person who's passed away. In some cultures, it is this grieving, but the expression of expressing certain emotions are not looked upon as culture. You know, you're not a cultured person if you do that, or it's not appropriate.
That was Kanika Inglit speaking with WUFT's Faith Smith about why it's encouraged to let your tears flow. To find more of Faith's work, check out WUFT.org/FM. The Rundown is a production of WUFT News out of the University of Florida College of Journalism and Communications. The team that made this show possible this week includes Dave Bariswain, Dana Hill, Rose Schnabel, Krista Jensen, and Faith Smith. Do you have comments or questions about the show today or ideas for future shows? Email us at therundown@wuft.org. Our trivia question this week was, although she seems to have left Alachua County behind, this Saturday Night Live comedian and actor was born in Gainesville. The answer? Maya Rudolph. That's it for The Rundown. I'm Kristen Shermont-Spina.